Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is just a quick announcement. There is something exciting coming up. Peter Hart's next book will be published by us, by Living History. Peter and I have come together and we're publishing a new book which will be out later in the year. And it's all about, drumroll please, the Gallipoli evacuation. That's right, how the Allies left Gallipoli at the end of the campaign. It's one of the most important chapters of the entire story, yet it's one of the most overlooked. But that's all about to change. No one has done as much work on this as Peter Hart has done for this book, and it's going to be really quite wonderful. So he's going to tell the whole story of the evacuation, the fears that they were going to lose 50% or 75% of the men trying to get off, that the Turks would break through and push the Allies into the sea as they were scrambling to get onto their boats, the politicians dithering about whether they should stay or whether they should leave, the diversionary attacks to draw attention away from the evacuations, and of course what the men were going through as they had to abandon their trenches, abandon their dead comrades, and leave Gallipoli forever. It's going to be just such a wonderful, wonderful book. And Peter tells the full story of the evacuation, all those details I've just described. But of course, as a wonderful oral historian, Peter, over the years, spoke to many of the veterans who went through this themselves. And so the book is full of first-hand accounts, and really the evacuation is told from the perspective of the men themselves. So it's going to be out in September 2020, but we are doing a pre-sale, which will start in about June and carry on for the next couple of months. And if you order the book during the pre-sale, you'll get a very special bonus from Peter Hart, which we will announce in the coming weeks. So look out for that, the book by Peter Hart, The Gallipoli Evacuation. It's really going to be something special.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Living History, again coming to you from lockdown. And I tell you what, talk about finding the silver lining in lockdown. I've been able to read lots of great books, do lots of great research, and talk to lots of great historians. Many more than I would otherwise have the opportunity to do if I was out and about. So I know everyone's struggling at the moment, but you've got to look for those small moments, those small silver linings. And this is one, speaking to a great historian, a bloke that just knows his stuff and is very enthusiastic about history. It's James Holland. James, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thanks, Matt. Good to be on. And nice to be seeing you via Zoom. And I'm only sorry, we were just talking about it, weren't we? You should have been over in the UK in June and you should have been at our Chalk Valley History Festival. But, you know, such is life.
I can't tell you how much I was looking forward to being at Chalk Valley. So, you know, is it the world's biggest history festival?
I don't know. I mean, it's certainly the most eccentric. It's you know, it's a real mixture of living history, kind of Spitfires and Lancasters flying overhead, talks by amazing historians, you know, live music, all the stuff you'd expect from a kind of sort of English country festival in the middle of absolutely nowhere. Lots of tents. Lots of noise, lots of bangs, lots of musketry. It's great. It is really, really good fun. So it's gutting that it can't happen this year. But, you know, it's very, very small beer in the big scheme of things, I suppose.
Well, absolutely. But certainly sign me up for next year. Hopefully next year when it's back up and running again, I'd love to be a part of it. It's going to be great.
Well, you bet.
But we're going to talk today about something that I think, you know, you probably have almost gotten a little bit sick of talking about. But I think for our listeners, something that we haven't covered enough on Living History, which is the Battle of Britain. And now, you know, it's, well, this is the first question. Is the Battle of Britain old hat? Has everyone just talked it to death? There's nothing new to discover. Where do we sit on the Battle of Britain?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can ever get bored of talking about 1940, Matt, so I'm very happy to be talking about this now. Well, it's an interesting one. So much about the Battle of Britain is sort of rooted in mythology. You know, the few, Spitfires and Hurricanes, as you know, they always say that, you know, the Spitfires and Hurricanes were the last line of defense against Nazi Germany, the hordes and all the rest of it. And actually, they weren't. They were the first line of defense, not the last line of defense. There was loads of other stuff, sort of, you know, the world's largest navy, for example, was sort of in between that and a German invasion. There was also, by August 1940, there was sort of, you know, 2.5 million men in uniform. Now, they weren't all kind of, I don't know if you get Dad's army over in Australia, but, you know, they weren't all kind of septuagenarians and doddering and kind of amateur. You know, some of them were pretty good. You know, particularly farmers who knew the lay of the land and all the rest of it. You know, you give them a rifle, they're pretty handy. So there's just so much sort of myth about it. You know, and whenever you see it, you know, it's always sort of cerulean skies, sort of white fluffy clouds and white cliffs of Dover, down Messerschmitt, you know, Vic of Spitfires flying overhead. And I think we've just, and also we've sort of come a bit mawkish about it as well, you know, about how, I mean, rightly we venerate the veterans, but you know, you've got to sort of put it in its right context. And I think, you know, this sort of David against Goliath, Little Britain against the sort of, you know, the mighty Nazi Moloch, you know, all that just needs kicking in the touch. You know, it really does. I mean, you know, one side was completely prepared for the Battle of Britain, fought it on its own terms, and fought very well with superior aircraft production, superior intelligence, superior tactics. And the other side was pretty clueless, didn't know really what it was doing, had absolutely woeful intelligence, aircraft production that was just falling through the floor, and lost hands down. And the first one is Britain and the second one is Germany.
Talk to me about aircraft production, because I heard you in a recent interview giving some statistics about this, which just absolutely blew me away about, I mean, obviously during the Second World War, the industrial capabilities of the combatants was always going to be key. But just run us through some of those statistics again about aircraft production, because it paints such a clear picture of how dominant Britain was always going to be in that battle.
Well, so in the run up to the Second World War, Germany is consistently producing more aircraft than anybody else, because it's just getting prepared for it, and Britain is a bit slow to catch up. And really interestingly, it's Neville Chamberlain, when he's Chancellor of Exchequer, who resists the calls from the army and says, no, what we need to prioritise is the Navy and the Air Force, and what we need to do is use steel, not flesh, in any future conflict, i.e. use mechanisation, global reach, industrialisation, mechanised vehicles, aircraft, ships, whatever, to do the hard yards instead of kind of sending lots of young men to the cold face of war and having another slaughter like we had in 1914-18. So that is a clear British strategy. And he's quite right. And then obviously when he takes over as Prime Minister in I think 1937 or whatever it is, you know, he sticks to his guns on this. You know, we must build up the Air Force. But even so, it's a bit late compared to Nazi Germany, which is why in the first year of the war, Germany has more aircraft than Britain does. But by the beginning of 1940, a lot of the things that have been put in place, shadow factories, for example. So something like the Supermarine Spitfire, that's made by Supermarine. Now, although that's owned by Vickers Armstrong, which is a much bigger enterprise and a really massive armaments producer, Supermarine itself is really small. It operates out of kind of, you know, hangars and sort of factory floor just down on Southampton Water, in Southampton. And what they have done in 1939 is start building these shadow factories, so i.e. sort of training up staff and building the machine tools to enable you to build, to expand from a kind of small operation down in Southampton to a much bigger national production line. And that is starting to come into being by kind of May 1940. But the real impetus for it is the appointment of Max Beaverbrook as the first Minister of Aircraft Production. So the Ministry of Aircraft Production comes into being in, I think, the 14th of May, and he becomes the Minister on 17th of May, something like that, give or take a day or so. And he's a classic kind of Churchillian technocrat. Churchill has taken over as Prime Minister on the 10th of May, same day that the Germans launched their attack in the West, in France and the Low Countries. And Beaverbrook has no experience of aircraft production whatsoever, but what he has got huge experience of is running a workforce and running a workforce efficiently, because he is part of the Beaverbrook media chain that kind of runs the Daily Express and various other newspapers. He's a media magnate, and he goes in and immediately kicks butt. And all the kind of normal processes, you know, sort of writing a letter, sitting on a desk for a couple of days, writing a letter back, sitting on a desk for a couple of days, you know, the whole process of a letter exchange taking kind of a week to 10 days. What he does is just gets on the blower. He gets on the phone. And if there's any bottleneck, he sends someone down to go and sort it out. So all bottlenecks are kind of just changed out. You know, he has signs up in his office saying things like, you know, committees take the punch out of war. You know, he's an absolute doer. You know, he has no kind of care for his workers, so they're all working sort of 24/7, 365. You know, he brings in all sorts of draconian laws. You know, everyone's just got to keep working. He reduces the number of aircraft to 5, so 3 bombers, 2 fighters. You know, no more. So let's not get distracted of anything else. What we've got to do is just produce loads of this type of fighter. And it is absolutely remarkable what he achieves in a very quick space of time, backed up by a lot of the things that have been put in place the year before, which are now coming to fruition, such as the shadow factories. So, for example, in July, so he takes over in the middle of May. Within 6 weeks, you know, he's improved aircraft production by about 68%. And he's improved production of engines, and not noticeably the Rolls-Royce Merlin, by something like 168% or 182%. It's some sort of gargantuanly high figure. And in July 1940, we produced 496 single-engine fighter aircraft, whereas Germany is producing 240, which is less than 50%. And that is the best ratio that the Germans are able to achieve in the whole of 1940. So it is... a big change. And what you've got is this very interesting graph during the Battle of Britain where we you know, by the 10th of July 1940, we've got something like about 640 aircraft available that morning. By October the 31st, we've got something like 780 single-engine aircraft available. So, i.e., the graph has just steadily gone up over the summer despite the losses. Whereas German single-engine fighter has started at about 740 available on the 10th of July and has gone down to around 200 by the 31st of October, you know, which is just pitiful. I mean, you know, they're absolutely on their knees at Luftwaffe by then. And it's also, Matt, sorry, one thing I should just say, is it's also not just brand new aircraft, it's also repaired aircraft. So he completely overhauls the civilian repair organisations, the CRO, and gives it different kind of classifications. So, you know, an aircraft, when it's damaged, can it be damaged in 24 hours or 36 hours or 48 hours on site at the airfield? Does it need to be taken away? If it is taken away, can it be put back in the air in a couple of weeks? Or does it need to be kind of stripped down for spares? And all that process is done incredibly quickly. So all the spare parts, he basically half inches from the Air Ministry and puts over to the Ministry of Air Production, locks all the doors, you know, puts combination locks on them that no one else can know apart from people in the Ministry of Air Production, and just completely runs and controls the whole thing like a czar, you know. And it's just incredibly successful. And you know, 30% of casualties in the Battle of Britain on both sides are accidents. So being able to kind of repair crashes and battle damage and just accidents as well is an incredibly important part of it. And of course, the Germans, they're operating in northwest France, a long way from their supply base, which is back in Germany. So that works massively against them. And even if their aircraft production was higher, they've still got to get them to the Pas-de-Calais or to Normandy or wherever the fighter aircraft airfields are. And to be perfectly honest, really, it's about fighter production rather than bomber production at this stage that's key.
James, the way you describe that, the thing about the Battle of Britain is it's always portrayed as a near-run thing. You know, the British hanging on by the skin of their teeth, they only just scraped through, the Germans were right on the cusp of an invasion. The way you're describing it, it doesn't sound like the Germans ever had much of a look-in in the Battle of Britain. Is that a fair assessment?
Totally fair assessment, yeah. I mean, just not a chance. Not a chance. And I'll take this in two stages, if I may, Matt. So one of the reasons why there's this persistent myth is because by the third and fourth week of August, Dowding, who was the Commander-in-Chief of Fighter Command, and Keith Park, who is the Commander-in-Chief of 11 Group, which is the... So Britain is divided into groups within Fighter Command, you know, so basically kind of geographical chunks of the country. And 11 Group is London, the southeast of England. So that's obviously the bit that's facing the worst of the German onslaught. And they think that they are now down in front, you know, Park's frontline squadrons by the end of August, beginning of September, are down to about 75% pilot strength. Now, they think that is really dangerously low. one of the reasons they think it's dangerous to the is because they think that German Staffeln, which is equivalent of a squadron, is based on the same principle as a British squadron, when in actual fact, it isn't. So, in a British squadron, you would have 22 to 24 pilots to service 20 to 22 aircraft, and you would never have more than 12 in the air at any one time. So, in other words, you've got a very, very tidy cushion of approximately 50%, but certainly kind of 40% cushion. Whereas a German Staffel has a maximum capability, a maximum number of 12, and very often is operational with 9 or 10. So their 75% strength is, you know, 8 or 9 pilots, whereas a British squadron's 75% strength is, you know, 16 to 18. So you've still got a cushion for 12. And the big point is that, that Dowding, at the end of the First World War, went back and became a trainer of men. He was commanding of a squadron in northern France before he did that. And he was very into kind of pilot care. He felt that pilot care was absolutely key to making sure that morale stayed high, that your efficiency stayed high, and all the rest of it. So that's why he's introduced this cushion on squadrons. It's part of his kind of general day-to-day care. Whereas, of course, the Nazis don't give a toss about that kind of stuff. You know, that's just not part, you know, you're a Nazi, you're part of a militaristic, you know, totalitarian state. So, of course, you don't worry about sort of pathetic things like having to have a good rest or anything. You know, so it's just not part of their thinking in the same way that it is the RAF. So, actual fact, compared to the Germans, they're actually doing okay. And one of the things that's really interesting is because aircraft production is so bad for the Germans, their fighter squadrons, by the beginning of September, they're having days where they've only got 3 aircraft or 1 aircraft or no aircraft or 5 aircraft. You know, in other words, they're below 50% of their strength. And that's when you consider their top strength is 12. So they're really below. And what that means is if you're a squadron commander in the Luftwaffe, a Staffel commander, what you're not going to do is let some greenhorn off with your precious Messerschmitt, which means that what's happening is German fighter pilots are just flying more and more and more and more, and they're becoming absolutely mentally and physically shot. Whereas British pilots, the whole point is to try and sort of nurse them and make sure they've got enough rest and all the rest of it. On the 7th of September 1940, which is a Saturday, which is when the Blitz starts, incidentally, what is really interesting is that Park that morning has a meeting with Dowding and Sholto Douglas and various other bigwigs and says, I've got this idea about pilot shortage, because one of the problems is this, again, there's this ongoing myth that, you know what, people were coming out of training and they only had 10 hours. Well, first of all, no one was flying with 10 hours. Okay, you have about 150 to 170. But what they mean is they only had 10 hours on type, i.e. a Spitfire or Hurricane. The numbers of pilots that were coming out of their operational training units with that little amount of flying was tiny. And the number of pilots who were then sent straight into the sky into combat with the Germans, you could literally count on one hand. So again, that's another myth that just absolutely needs to be kicked into touch. Because no squadron leader is going to send a new greenhorn with 10 hours on a Hurricane or a Spitfire into battle, because they're going to do more harm than good. It just makes no sense whatsoever. So what Park comes up with is this squadron classification. So an A squadron is a squadron that has fully 100% experienced pilots. A C squadron is one that has mostly greenhorns and maybe 4 or 5 experienced pilots. And a B squadron is one that's kind of sort of 50-50. And the idea is your A squadrons are in the front line, down in Kent in number 11 group, and your C squadrons are up in Drem in Edinburgh or Accrington in Northumberland or somewhere like that, where you're far away from the action, and where, you know, perhaps a lone Junkers 88 from Stavanger in Norway might come over and you can sort of get a bit of real experience of combat flying against something that's quite a soft target. And in between, you can just build up your hours. And then when you're ready, then you can transfer to an A squadron, a category A squadron. And because everything within fighter command is completely standardized, all you've got to do is just fly from one airfield to another and you're in a new squadron. You know, there's no, you know, because everything's based the same. So there's no unfamiliarity or anything. So this is incredibly sensible. The Germans, on the other hand, they're losing numbers. They're losing pilots. They haven't got enough spare parts. They can't repair their aircraft quick enough. And they're really looking down the barrel. And at the same time, they're making these plans for the invasion of Britain, which is Operation Sea Lion. And the whole thing is just completely cockeyed, because Hitler never intends to do an invasion because he thinks that Britain is going to sue for peace. And this is because Hitler has absolutely no geopolitical understanding whatsoever. His worldview is incredibly myopic, and he views his enemies as he does through his own mind. So in his mind, the most important thing is the army, because he's a landlubber and he's a continentalist. So for him, Britain losing its army at Dunkirk must be enough to bring down a government or make them definitely sue for peace. Not realising, of course, that we've traditionally, Britain has had a very small army, and the reason the Royal Navy is called the Senior Service is because it's a senior service, because that's the key to Britain's empire and global trade and successes over the previous, 200 years. And so he just doesn't see it in that light. And then he's very sensibly got the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, which is a combined services general staff, but he doesn't use it as that. He uses it as his mouthpiece. So what you get is, in the beginning of July, after his triumphant return to Berlin and, a quarter of a million people out there cheering and waving swastikas and all the rest of it, he then retreats to the Berghof in the mountains in Bavaria, which is incredibly unhelpful because it's quite difficult to get to. It's a bit like sort of Churchill sort of retreating to Scotland or something in kind of July 1940. I mean, just really, really unhelpful. And there he gets the army to come along, and he says, right, so what's your plan for invading Britain? And they go, well, mein Führer, we're thinking, we'd attack on a really broad front from Lyme Regis to Deal, which is about kind of 90 miles. And then he goes, okay, fine, well, you go off and plan that. And then he says to the Navy, well, what's your plan then? And they go, well, mein Führer, we're thinking we should attack on a really narrow front of maybe kind of a couple of miles at Deal. And he goes, well, off you go then. And then, he says to Goering, well, what's your plan then? He goes, well, we're just going to smash the RAF and it's going to be great. And there's just no joined up thinking whatsoever. They don't have any landing craft, so they're having to fashion stuff. They've got a few Siebel ferries, which are quite cool, but, they'll just sink the moment there's a kind of the faintest whiff of a swell in the channel. Now, what they're going to use is river barges from the Rhine, and they don't have enough which are motorized, so one motorized is going to be towing two unmotorized ones. Can you imagine it? And then they've got to actually land on the beach. It's just absolutely hopeless. Meanwhile, there are 16 squadrons in Bomber Command ready with chemical weapons to drop on any invasion fleet, and you've got the world's largest navy waiting for them, all based around the southeast of England, and you've got the Harry Tate's Navy, which is this sort of auxiliary service made up from sort of fishermen and trawlermen who've, stamped a kind of, an Oerlikon on the proud poop deck or something. And they're mine laying and mine sweeping and keeping a watch for the invasion. It has no chance. And if you then think to kind of fast forward to 1944 and you think of all the jeopardy there is for D-Day and the Normandy invasion with total control of the skies, with total control of the seas, with sort of unbelievable kind of sophisticated landing craft and all the rest of it, and there's still a massive doubt. Little old Nazi Germany, with its kind of sort of backward invasion plans, it just doesn't have a hope in hell. Sorry, that was an incredibly long-winded answer, wasn't it?
No, I loved it, mate. I don't know if you could tell, but I was just hanging on every word. That's why we're on the show, mate. We love getting these perspectives, and that's what I want to talk about now. There is a perception, if we talk about perceptions of the Second World War, the perception that everyone has, I won't say everyone, but yep, lots of people have, is that Germany was militaristically ahead of everyone else. They were the dominant fighters, and, the strategy and the way they conquered Western Europe and the unstoppable Nazis. Do we give them too much credit? A lot of this description sounds like they were ill-prepared, they hadn't thought their plans out correctly, they didn't have the infrastructure and the resources to put these plans into place. Do we give the Germans too much credit? Did they just get lucky in the early days of the war? How has it come to be that, given the reality of so many shortcomings, we see them as the dominant force during the Second World War?
Sort of yes and no, because what they do have is they have a spearhead of their army which is very well prepared for the operations for which it starts the war with, i.e. Poland, the Blitzkrieg years. Though in actual fact, I should qualify that with Poland because as I'm sure you know, actually they started running out of ammunition and it wasn't quite the kind of sort of well-oiled machine as it should have been. If you look at the kind of opposition they've got in the kind of first couple of years of the war, what have you got? You've got Norway. Well, that just hasn't got hope in hell of defeating the Germans. Denmark, not a hope in hell. Belgium and Holland, because they just don't have sophisticated armed forces. So they've got armed forces, but they're just not sophisticated in the way that the Germans are. And there is this whole kind of sort of Prussian thing that's sort of hovering in the background, that, you know, that's what they do, and that, that we're a kind of martial, militaristic nation. And the whole point about Nazi Germany is it's militaristic. So it's completely honed to that. Whereas the Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, they are not militaristic societies. They're democracies. You know, they're just not in that kind of mindset. And then what they've also honed is the Luftwaffe, but the Luftwaffe has grown organically as what we would now call a tactical air force to offer close air support. It is not a strategic air force. So a strategic air force is one that is, I mean, you know all this, of course, Matt, is one that is operating on its own, regardless of anything else. So, you know, that is why a bomber force is, you know, the 8th Air Force or RAF Bomber Command is a strategic air force, because it's just going off and bombing cities. It's got no involvement with the Navy, no involvement with the Army or anything like that. Occasionally it does, but basically it's operating on its own. So that's a strategic air force. A tactical air force is one which is supporting operations on the ground. And that is how the Luftwaffe has organically grown, to enhance land operations. So that is what it's very good at doing in those early years. Sweeping in as the spearhead, shooting stuff up, Stukas bombing and stuff. And Stukas work when you've got air superiority, where you control the airspace. Then they can dive down. They dive down low. And because they're operating low, you don't need bomb sites and stuff, because you're kind of virtually on top of the target. So that makes the target easier, which means you need less ordnance to achieve what you want, which is why a Stuka is a single engine plane, blah, blah, blah. And you don't need big four engine heavy bombers and bomb sites and all the rest of it. So that's the thinking behind that. But obviously that only works when you've got control of the airspace. But in those early years, they do. Then you think, push forward a little bit and go into the Balkans, go into Greece. It's the same thing. You know, Yugoslavia, Greece, you know, these are countries which don't have a developed military in the same sense that Germany does. And Germany has some really fantastic weapons, you know, incredibly good machine guns like the MG-34, submachine guns, the MP-38 at the time, you know, the 88mm dual-purpose anti-tank, anti-aircraft gun, 75mm pack guns, you know, really high velocity. And it does have some tanks. You know, the tanks are pretty kind of feeble for the most part. That doesn't matter, because it's the anti-tank gun which is the key high velocity weapon, and because they've got a very, very enhanced radio system, they're all able to communicate with one another. The only odd one out in all this is France, which has a much larger army than Germany, has more, double the number of artillery pieces, has double the number of tanks, has bigger tanks with bigger guns and all the rest of it. And on paper, just looking at the arsenal, should have won. The problem for France in 1940 is it doesn't have good comms. And what the Germans have done in the 1930s, and done brilliantly, because they're not terribly automotive, actually. Again, you know, everyone talks about the kind of Nazi war machine. It's actually a bit of a misnomer, because, you know, the 135 divisions that are used to invade the West, the Low Countries and France on 10th of May 1940, only 16 of them are motorised. The other 119 are using what they've always used, you know, horses, carts, and the 2 feet of the soldiers. You know, so they're really, really under-mechanized. It's a complete kind of myth, this idea of them being massively mechanized. And there's some really interesting statistics on all this. There's, in 1939, summer of 1939, there are, I think it's 105 Italians for every motorized vehicle in Italy. There are 47 Germans for every motorized vehicle in Germany. That figure is 14 in Britain, 8 in France, and 3 in the USA. So France is by far and away the most automotive society in Western Europe. In Europe, full stop. And second only to the United States of America. And Britain obviously is pretty high as well. But Britain has a very small army, but which is 100% mechanised. But the Germans aren't this sort of great machine that they're kind of believed to be. But what they do have, and what they have used very successfully as a propaganda tool in the early 1930s, is the development of radios. So what they realise, what the Nazis realise, what Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda chief, realises, is that actually comms is the kind of key to getting across the Nazi message. You just effectively brainwash a whole country by just repeating the same old shit over and over and over and over and over again. And what they do is they develop a thing called the Deutsche Kleinempfänger, which is the German little radio, which is 9 inches by about 4 inches by 4 inches. A little kind of plastic Baker-like kind of thing. And if you think about the 1930s, you know, most radio sets were kind of great big walnut things. They're absolutely huge. They kind of fit in your living room. They're incredibly expensive. And they're for the bourgeoisie and the, you know, middle and upper classes. They're not for the kind of lower classes. And what the Germans do is make radio acceptable for absolutely everybody. And they have the highest usage of radios per person, per family, anywhere in the world, including the United States, by 1939. And of course, what the good folk in the Wehrmacht think is, hang on a minute, we've got all these small radios, we can develop these for our military. So what you've got with a Panzer division is not a division which of 15,000 plus men, which is full of tanks. What you've got is a combined arms motorized formation of motorized infantry, reconnaissance, artillery, and of course tanks as well. And they can all communicate with one another, which is why they're able to move and exploit gaps and developments really, really quickly. The problem with the French is the French don't have very many radios. And in fact, the Château de Vincennes, which is the headquarters of the commander-in-chief of the German, of the French armed forces, which is General Maurice Gamelin, doesn't even have a telephone in the Château de Vincennes. But they are completely dependent on telephone lines, which of course are being shot to pieces by Stukas and by war damage and all the rest of it. And so the flip side of that, so if you can't communicate by telephone, what do? Well, you send out a dispatch rider. But the roads are now clogged with refugees. So what do? You know, you send off and because they've got this incredibly top-heavy command structure, so they've got armed forces, army groups, armies, corps, divisions, you know, regiments, brigades rather, battalions, etc., etc., etc. Every single one of those. So say at the top of the chain, at the army group level, you want to move several divisions, you know, a corps forward to meet a German threat. You've got to go from your army group to your army, to your corps, to your divisions, to your individual units. That's all got to happen very quickly. If it doesn't happen quickly, it ain't going to happen at all. And the problem they have is the message comes from army group, gets sent at 6 o'clock in the morning too, but the telephone's cut. So they then have to send a dispatch rider, but he hasn't come back by 12. Because he's fallen off or he's met a sort of, you know, log jam of refugees or whatever. So they send out another one at midday. He comes back by 9, by which time the whole situation's completely changed. And this is happening at every level of the process. So this inability to communicate with each other, what that means is this much advanced French military simply can't move. Whereas the Germans just go, you know, and whiz around all over the place because they can all talk to each other. So the success in 1940 is 50% German brilliance and 50% French lack of comms and ineptitude. And that is why France comes. But everyone else, they're not particularly, you know, to a half decent military outfit, you know, none of those, that opposition should have been much of an issue. And so it proves. So are the Germans any good? Yes and no. You know, that's the short of it. They're not on the pedestal that they've been put. They're still damn good, but it needs qualification.
Given that situation, is there anything the Germans could have done in the Battle of Britain to achieve what they set out to do? Or was it always going to be a failure?
I think it was always going to be a failure because I just don't think they had the intelligence. You know, they didn't realise that we had the world's first fully coordinated air defence system. The reason why the Luftwaffe was able to maraud so freely over France is because France didn't have an air defence system. It just didn't have one. You know, not in the way that we know. Not integrated with radar and observer corps and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And a sort of a single kind of processing point which can then be filtered out. They just don't have that. So the Luftwaffe can maraud entirely on their terms. And the best way to destroy another air force is to destroy it on the ground. So what you want to do is come over en masse, hammer an airfield, destroy all the aircraft on the ground, go back, kind of attack another one. That's the way to do it. Whereas because the British and the RAF and the French Army of the Air don't know when the Germans are coming, all they've got to do is sort of just take off every day and kind of sort of fly around the sky and hope that they bump into the Luftwaffe. And then they have a fight. And, you know, they do have lots of fights and they shoot down lots of Luftwaffe planes. But it's not enough. And suddenly the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain are coming up against an enemy that knows when they're coming, so knows to get off the ground when the Germans are coming towards them. And, you know, out of 138 airfields in Britain in 1940, only one of them has put out of action for more than 24 hours, and that's Manston. Only one. You know, I mean, the whole object of the Battle of Britain, the whole strategy, the whole aim of what the Luftwaffe is trying to do is destroy the RAF on the ground and knock out airfields, destroy aircraft on the ground. And they just don't achieve it. And one of the reasons they don't achieve it is because of the air defence system. The other reason is because to actually destroy an airfield is, when it's grass and it's about 100 acres in size, actually requires a vast amount of ordnance. And Dornier 17s and Heinkel 111s, which are their mainstay bombers, are feeble compared to what's coming later on in the war. I mean, you know, they could carry almost nothing, like a couple of tons of bombs, that's it. I mean, that is not a lot by later Second World War standards. You know, Lancaster can carry 10 tons of bombs if it needs to. You know, that's a proper load. And obviously B-29, even more. So, you know, they just don't have enough. They don't have enough bombers. They don't have enough ordnance to do it. I mean, you know, the RAF destroy Hamburg in late July, early August 1943 with 3,500 heavy bombers. You know, the number of times that the Luftwaffe are flying over 100 bombers at one time, you can literally count on one hand in the Battle of Britain. You know, that increases a little bit during the Blitz. But, I mean, you know, even take Battle of Britain Day, September the 15th, Sunday, September the 15th, 1940, day that's gone down as Battle of Britain Day. The biggest raid on that day peaks at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, southeast London. And that is 100 bombers, 200 escorts. Ranged against them are 335 Spitfires and Hurricanes. So obviously, if you are one of 12 in a squadron and you're attacking 300, you feel massively outnumbered. But if you're a historian and you're looking at this and you're standing back a little bit, you look at that and you go, 300 Luftwaffe aircraft being attacking 335 defenders. No chance, because everyone knows the rule of thumb is kind of 3-to-1 advantage, numerical advantage when you attack. And, you know, they're just not achieving that. You know, there's this kind of famous bit where Churchill goes down to the bunker at Uxbridge, where Keith Park is, commander of 11 Group. And because of the air ventilation system, he can't have his cigar lit. So he's got a sort of unlit cigar stuck in his jaw. And he goes, "Where are all the reserves?" And Park turns to him and says, "There are none." And it's always, when it's always recounted in this kind of sort of, you know, dun dun dun, kind of sort of, you know, big moment of, you know, the fate of the world rests on the shoulder of these 335 Spitfires and Hurricanes. But our interpretation of that is entirely mythological. I mean, he might have gone, "Oh, there's none," but actually, there's no, but you know, because I've decided to put them all up at once because I think that's the most effective use of them. But obviously, you know, 13 Group and 12 Group and 10 Group, they've got loads left, so you know, don't worry about it. But he doesn't, you know, that's not how it's reported. So we always think of it as this kind of sort of life and death close run thing moment. When in actual fact, it's not particularly, because even with 335 in the air at one time, when he says there's no reserves, it means he hasn't got any more reserves in 11 Group, but it's ignoring the other 400 Spitfires and Hurricanes were in the rest of fighter command, because we've got about 750 by that point.
Well, it's a good point, James, how we remember the Battle of Britain. And I thought of this week because it's been Anzac Day here, and I did a huge number of interviews and talking all about why Anzac Day is so important to Australia and Gallipoli and the fact that it was this defeat, yet we still take so much out of it. And, you know, at the end of the day, the best thing I could come up with was Australia needs Gallipoli. We just do. That's the way we see ourselves, the way we see our history. We just need Gallipoli. Is the Battle of Britain the same for the British?
Yeah, I think it is. I think just the Second World War generally. I mean, you know, if you think about, you know, the British Empire, there were a lot of good things that came out of the British Empire, but there's a lot of really bad things as well. And obviously, experience of the British Empire was different. I mean, you know, if you're in Nigeria, you wouldn't say there was anything good about it at all. I mean, there's quite a few things that good that came out of it. If you're Indian, I suppose, you know, legal system, schools, railways, blah, 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 unification of a nation, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, empire's not great. And a lot of the wars we've got involved with have been pretty grubby. You know, not our finest hours, all that kind of stuff. The thing about the Second World War is it's got a sort of real moral crusade to it. It was a good thing to be involved in that. And I think the other thing about it is it's just the totality of the effort. You know, there wasn't a single man, woman and child that was living in Britain, and indeed the dominions and all the rest of it at the time that didn't have a direct part in the Second World War. And, you know, the world would have been immeasurably worse had Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany prevailed. So, you know, it is a good thing, and it is a reference point. You know, and obviously it's been a massive reference point at the moment because of COVID-19, and you know, we're facing this new war, but a war against a disease. And you know, it's suddenly that restrictions on day-to-day life, that sort of dramatic change in day-to-day life which you only kind of experience with something like a global pandemic or a war. So it's not surprising that we're kind of making all those comparisons, I suppose. But I don't know. I mean, I just think it's the role of the historians to try and sort of clarify things and kind of move myth away and create a reality, you know. And it's just, you know, Hollywood has a big part in all this, of course, and just sort of general mythologizing. But it's very hard to kind of change people's minds on this stuff. I mean, you know, that I've got my view on the Battle of Britain and I'm sticking to it, you know. And I mean, there was a thing on Twitter this morning saying, you know, what are the most important aircraft of the Second World War? And someone said, I can't believe no one's mentioned the Hurricane. Well, the Hurricane wasn't important at all. I mean, you know, it wasn't a game changer. It was slow to climb. Yeah. It was old fashioned. It was a kind of sort of, you know, it was basically a biplane that should be converted into a monoplane and given a Rolls Royce Merlin engine. But it wasn't a great plane at all. It's just we had more of them than Spitfires in 1940, and because they were so slow to climb, they were given the bombers, which were easier to shoot down than Messerschmitt 109s and 110s. So obviously their total, A, there were more of them, and B, the targets they were hitting were easier, so they shot down more than Spitfires. But that's, you know, so what? I mean, you know, we needed that aircraft in 1940, don't get me wrong, you know, it has its place, but the idea that it's one of the most decisive aircraft of the Second World War, when you're kind of thinking about kind of, I don't know, P-51D Mustangs and Corsairs and ME-262s and so on and so forth, and Mosquitoes, you know, not a chance. But it's all part of that kind of mythology, isn't it?
So how, I mean, it's a tough question, but how should we remember the Battle of Britain, in your opinion?
Well, I think we should remember it for a really, really amazingly good effort. I mean, I do think it is important. I do think it was a massive game changer in the war, because, you know, because Germany is sort of landlocked in continental Europe for the most part. It has a bit of the Baltic Sea, but it's difficult to get in and out. And it's got a bit of the North Sea, but that's difficult to get out. It's basically, it's a continental power. Because it's resource poor, because it doesn't have access to the world's oceans in the way that the other big players did, it was always going to be about fighting short, sharp wars. And this is what traditionally Prussia has always done. It's what, it's what Nazi Germany continues to do. It is, let's hit very hard with massive Schwerpunkt, you know, my point of impact, overwhelm the enemies very, very quickly, and win very, very quickly. It's all about short, sharp, punchy wars, because history has taught the German people that whenever it gets stuck into a long attritional war, it loses because it doesn't have the access to resources. What's really interesting about the Battle of Britain is it looks like Germany's won just beforehand. And Battle of Britain and Britain's refusal to come to heel and sue for peace means that that Germany is consigned to a long war. It means that the only way it's going to get the much needed resources, particularly of oil and fuel, but a whole load of other stuff as well, is by going into the Soviet Union. Originally planned for 1943, 1944, but suddenly hustled forward to June 1941, when it is simply not ready for the scale of the operation that it is about to undertake. And so it comes to prove, you know, by November, it's unraveling. By the beginning of December, by the middle of December, it is completely unraveled, and it is simply not going to win the war. And if you think about it, think about an arbitrary date like the 15th of June, 1941. Nazi Germany has one enemy. It has Great Britain, albeit Britain with its dominions, including Australia. Fast forward 6 months, it's got three enemies. It's got Britain plus its dominions, United States of America, and the USSR. Is it going to win? No. It just... The outcome is no longer, you know, the end point is no longer in doubt. Germany will lose the war. What is in doubt, and obviously what is completely unknowable at this stage in the end of 1941, is how long it's going to go on for, what the post-war world will look like, all that kind of stuff. That's all very much to be kind of fought over. But Germany's ability to win the war has gone by the end of 1941, which I would say is kind of sort of, you know, most people say it's Stalingrad, don't they? Which is early February, beginning of February 1943. I mean, much earlier than that. And that is a direct response to what happens in the Battle of Britain. So the Battle of Britain is really, really, really important. And one thing I think it is really important is that strategic importance doesn't necessarily equate to boots on the ground. And I think there has this been, no one should belittle the kind of unbelievable loss of life on the Eastern Front. And no one should belittle the titanic struggle that took place there, or how much the grinding, you know, how much the Wehrmacht was chewed up on the Eastern Front. But you have to be very careful not to overemphasize The Eastern Front compared to what's going on in the Western Front and all the rest of it. And in terms of kind of material damage, the West causes more damage to Germany, I think, than the Eastern Front does. Because you're just looking at that in terms of kind of manpower, in terms of kind of breaking Germany as a military power, in terms of its kind of, you know, breaking it economically. The strategic air campaign, the kind of the bigger picture, the kind of the Battle of the Atlantic. I mean, the Battle of the Atlantic is the most important theatre in the Second World War, because through the Atlantic flows absolutely everything, whether it's coming from Australia, whether it's coming from the United States or whatever. You know, that is how you defeat Germany, is through the Atlantic. And the Germans don't get that. And what is interesting about the Battle of Britain is the number of people directly involved in the actual fighting is obviously comparatively small, and very small compared to what happens, you know, on the Eastern Front later on in a couple of years' time. But that doesn't mean that it should be diminished strategically. You know, it is an absolutely key turning point. And it's probably a bigger turning point than Hitler realizes at the time.
It's been just wonderful, mate. Before we finish up, I know you're working on a Sicily book, or have you finished the Sicily book now? What are you up to with that?
Yeah,
tell
me
all about that.
Yep. Sicily's done. I'm literally just sort of, you know, doing appendices and that kind of stuff at the moment. So yeah, no, that's pretty much put to bed, thank goodness. And yeah, what a fascinating project that's been, because, you know, it's just been hardly anything written about it. I mean, the last major account of the Sicilian campaign was in its own right was probably Carlo d'Este and his book, which is called Bitter Victory. Which came out in 1988, you know, so it's kind of over 30 years ago. It's a hell of a long time ago, really. So it's been fascinating to do it, and it probably won't surprise you to have a slightly different take from him. I kind of think of him as a bit of a declinist, you know, he's kind of pretty down on the Allied war effort. Okay, so the big thing about that, I'll just tell you this very quickly. It's really interesting. It's like, so the big downer on the Sicilian campaign is that so many Germans got away. Okay, but again, all this stuff, kind of stuff. So something like 39,500 Germans got away in total. From Sicily, which, you know, I'm sort of thinking, you know, compared to the kind of 43,000 British soldiers that got away from Greece, that doesn't sound like a huge amount to me. And of those, only 25,000 are frontline troops which go away from which get away from the actual evacuation operation, which is called Operation Lehrgang, in the kind of, you know, from the 11th to the 16th of August 1943, which is less than two divisions. I mean, you know, so it's not that much. And I don't know why the kind of, you know, Allied historians, you know, Anglophone historians are sort of beating themselves up about this. Because, I mean, that's going to make absolutely no difference to the subsequent Italian campaign at all. It's just not enough to kind of make that kind of difference. Particularly when you compare, when you consider how many German divisions are being poured into Italy, ready for an Allied invasion. So it's just not the big game changer at all. And the second thing about it is, if you look at evacuations in the Second World War, nearly all of them are successful. You know, starting with Dunkirk and ending with Operation Hannibal, which is the evacuation of over 2 million Germans in kind of basically ships that don't work from East Prussia, you know, Königsberg and all around there and kind of the Danzig corridor and all that kind of stuff. You know, 2 million Germans right at the end of the war with the kind of, you know, the Red Army breathing down, they still managed to get 2 million out. You know, so it kind of proves that most evacuations are incredibly successful. So I just, you know, I think, you know, you wander around, I don't know if you've ever been to Sicily, Matt, but if you ever go there,
I've been there,
okay.
It's great.
Yeah, it's, isn't it? And you look at that and you just think, 38 days to capture this place, bloody good effort.
Well, it's great. Is the book out now? When's the book going to be out? I mean, I suppose COVID is getting in the way.
Yeah, no, September 8th. You know, assuming that people are able to buy books again then.
Well, we'll look out for that one, and a great topic for the next podcast, mate. But as always, James, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show, and just thank you for giving us our time, because I just love the new insights and the, you know, we've always got to ask new questions, and I don't think enough of us do that. So it's always fantastic to have you on the show to talk about these things.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on, Matt.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.